Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we take a look at the alarming number of pedestrians and cyclists who have died on Bakersfield City streets in the last few years. We'll talk with Zachary Griffin of the group Vision Zero Kern, who says local leaders should be doing more.
I feel that education trumps infrastructure in the sense that education can be applied right now to any situation. Infrastructure often takes a lot of time and a lot of money to get in place.
Plus, an in-depth look at the issue of human trafficking in the Valley, and specifically a look at troubling new ways traffickers are ensnaring young women from all backgrounds in what is being called modern-day slavery. We'll talk with Rory and Alexandra Appleton of the Fresno Bee. We begin, though, with a look at a possible turnaround for one long-struggling Fresno community. If you turn on the cable channel HGTV, you'll see a 24-hour succession of home renovation shows offering the promise of turning coal into a diamond. A renovation of a different sort could be underway in one of the most long-neglected areas of Fresno. In recent weeks, a series of developments have fallen into place that have activists and community residents wondering if they're finally ready for a renovation reveal of their own. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports from Southwest Fresno.
Courtney Gooch is a 26-year-old Fresno native who returned from college 2 years ago to purchase her very first home, a quiet ranch home on a third of an acre on Kearney Boulevard in Southwest Fresno.
So I bought this house, and it was a one owner, and it hadn't been remodeled since the 60s.
And Gooch is a ball of exciting energy and enthusiasm when talking about the home, which she has spent the better part of the last 2 years bringing into the modern age. New floors and ceilings, a trendy open concept floor plan, and plenty of room to grow with extra bedrooms and a backyard basketball court.
It's actually really quiet in the evenings. So I like it. I have like a little side area. My plan is to put a garden over there. We got that.
Gooch loves showing her home to old high school friends and thinks many of them are ready to become new neighbors.
Because there's a lot of people that leave and they don't come back and they forget about where they came from. And it's going to take people like me to come back and revitalize this area and let people know that young, educated, single women want to still be in this area and we want to continue to help it to grow.
In recent weeks, Gooch, elected officials and activists say the pieces are finally in place to unlock the potential they feel has been trapped for too long by bad public policy and neglect. Recently, the Fresno City Council approved a new specific plan for the area, intended to streamline and accelerate the development of new homes and businesses. The long-maligned Darling Rendering Plant has been approved to move out of the congested community into a remote area outside of town, and plans are nearing completion on how residents in the area would like to spend some of the $70 million in cap-and-trade funds set aside specifically to improve their community. Gooch says this is the critical mass of projects the area has been waiting on, not just a fresh coat of paint. Fresno City Council member Oliver Baines represents Southwest Fresno and parts of downtown. For much of the last 8 years, he's been pushing to implement new planning documents that will guide and ease development. He contends the foundation of Southwest Fresno did not crumble of its own accord, but rather as the result of years of unfocused half-plans and neglect. That, he says, is all different now.
I will tell you that what we will see in the very near future is more investment in Southwest Fresno, as you've already noticed already. So because there were so many people closely watching this process, people that invest in neighborhoods and invest in retail and housing and commercial development, they are excited to now come and invest in Southwest Fresno.
Bain says each of the three pieces fits together. Moving the Darling plant.
I think that it's a win-win-win scenario. So I think Darling wins right along with the community.
Which was blamed for creating foul odors and contributing to industrial traffic, is as important as bringing in new development dollars. And that may be coming in the form of $70 million in cap-and-trade funds set aside for polluted and impoverished areas like Southwest, Chinatown, and downtown Fresno. The portion that is headed to Southwest Fresno is intended to spur local government and private development dollars. The city has nearly completed the list of projects they want to see funded under the so-called Transformative Climate Communities Program, or TCC. Everything from new multifamily construction, amenities like community gardens and parks, and maybe even a brand new satellite campus of Fresno City College. College President Carol Goldsmith says they have long-eyed a new campus in the area. She says the new addition could inject fresh life from nearby towns, not just from the Southwest Fresno community.
California's first community college has another opportunity to be a first in our history here, and that's really to take a bold step to start to change the narrative of Fresno having the tale of two cities.
While the draft TCC plan has an expectation of where the college would be built, Goldsmith says they still have to go through their own process before any final decisions are made. While a new community college is a big get, there are many smaller projects also in line to help pad out what many people consider to be basic amenities, like grocery stores or access to fresh fruits and vegetables. Fresno Metro Ministry says they are planning on establishing a community garden where residents can grow their own food. But organizer Tom Matok cautions this is just the front door, not the finished home.
But these things, if these are going to be answers, growing food directly in those communities that don't have access to it, we're going to need to have lots of them. There's not just one site. We've got big farms all over the place, right? And we still have issues around access.
And for Courtney Gooch, she says she's ready and excited to take on the challenge and thinks for the first time in a long time, there are many more people like her ready to jump in.
So it's not something that people have to get ready for. We've been ready, you know, so now it's just getting it going and not allowing it to stop where it's at now.
The city and activists have made big promises to residents to earn back their trust. Now they'll be watching closely to see if this time change is on the way. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Just as Southwest Fresno is poised to get a makeover, the city's transportation system is also getting ready for one. The city announced last month that it plans to restructure its bus system for the first time in decades with public input. But as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, there are bound to be limitations, and that has some community members concerned.
Dave Alcanzar lives in central Fresno. He's in his 70s and in a wheelchair and relies on Fresno Area Express, or FAX, to get everywhere. Today, to go grocery shopping, he's at Blackstone and Dakota Avenues waiting for the 45 bus, which he just missed. He'll have to wait about an hour for the next one. But even then, if it arrives with two wheelchairs already on board, he won't fit, and he'll have to wait another hour. A problem he's encountered on many of Fresno's bus routes.
A couple of weeks ago, I had a doctor's appointment, and it was 2.5 hours before they could pick me up because the buses were too full.
On the weekends, Alcanzar would like to go out to dinner or see live music, but the routes he would typically take stop running between 6 and 7 p.m., so he gets discouraged and finds himself taking the bus less and less.
I mean, that's what I do. I get frustrated and I just stay home.
Riders like Alcanzar have been voicing their concerns about FAX for a long time. Now, with a series of public workshops over the next month, the city claims it's ready to collect that feedback and incorporate it into a redesign of the whole system. Jim Shad is Fresno's Director of Transportation.
We are trying to understand what our customers want, both current customers and potential customers, to see if we can bolster ridership.
Since 2010, FAX ridership has fallen by nearly half. Ridership levels haven't been this low since the late 1990s. If revenue drops too low, the city could lose federal subsidies that support the system. So, Shad says, FAX needs an overhaul. He shows me a map of the system on the wall.
It is currently what's called a hub-and-spoke system. So
right now, the Manchester Mall at Blackstone and Shields and Courthouse Park in downtown serve as major bus hubs, with routes radiating outward. The FAX system has been structured like this since at least the 1970s, even though Fresno's population has nearly doubled since then.
As the city grew larger, those buses had to travel further distances, and it's become inefficient.
Fresno did just increase bus frequency along two routes near Fresno State, and in February, it'll unveil its new bus rapid transit line called FAX-Q. Q buses will run at 10-minute intervals along Blackstone Avenue and Kings Canyon Road. Throughout the system, Shad says more frequent buses is one of the most common requests he receives, along with more bus lines in general. But because of budget limitations, we probably can't have both.
The farther we stretch our resources to get to more locations, the more difficult it is to serve the customers in our core service and get them to their locations faster.
These limitations leave Grecia Elenes concerned about equitability. She's a policy advocate with the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, and she works with residents in West and Southwest Fresno, two communities served by relatively few bus lines. She worries the city will favor the denser parts of the city over more disadvantaged areas.
So I think that would be worst case scenario where these folks aren't able to get access to healthy foods, get access to Fresno City College or Fresno State or anything like that.
Elena says, yeah, getting big 40-foot buses out to all these neighborhoods every 15 minutes would be difficult and expensive, which is why planners should be thinking beyond typical transit buses.
There are express buses. There are car share companies and programs that are out there. There are all these solutions that other cities have provided that are kind of increasing the ridership and getting the residents and the commuters to their destinations.
Henobeba Islas is program director of the health advocacy nonprofit Cultiva La Salud. She argues for Fresno's most disadvantaged residents, access to reliable public transportation could radically change quality of life.
Transportation is literally pathways out of people's poverty. People need good systems to get educated. They need good systems in order to have, you know, employment.
At Blackstone in Dakota, Dave Alcanzar reminisces about San Jose, where he used to live. He loved the Bay Area's connectivity, which he says is lacking here. Still, though, he says Fresno's system does have one important thing going for it.
The drivers are nice.
The city is hosting five more FACTS workshops this week and a final one in early December. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. According to a new report from the city of Bakersfield, 64 pedestrians and cyclists have been killed in accidents in the city in the last 3.5 years. The new bicycle and pedestrian safety report says only around a quarter of those accidents were the fault of drivers. The report also highlights new efforts to make the city more friendly for those on foot and on bikes, including new sidewalks, a planned trail along the Fryant-Kern Canal, and new bike lanes, parking, and even a bike-sharing program planned for downtown Bakersfield. Our next guest, though, says those numbers are low compared to the scope of the problem in real life. He is Zachary Griffin. He's the director of a group called Vision Zero Kern, which aims to reduce to zero the number of cyclists and pedestrians killed on Bakersfield streets. Zachary, welcome to Valley Edition.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're saying that this city report that is now out only is showing a part of the picture here of pedestrian and cyclist deaths. Why is that?
Well, first of all, just looking at this year in general, we've had 36 pedestrian fatalities, I believe, to date, and we still have a couple months, sadly, to collect on average probably around 4 each month. So we could push 40 easily just in pedestrian fatalities this year. And that would be coupled with, say, last year's, I think, was 30 or 28, something along that line. So that's almost 64 that you mentioned in two of those 3 years that they're referring to. So this has been on steady incline since probably early 2006. And it does just scratch the surface to the myriad of issues that we face here in Kern County.
Let's just go back here because I think our listeners are confused. The city report says 64 pedestrians since 2014 through October of this year. You're saying it's a lot more than that. Why is there this discrepancy?
Because the simple issues that face our region or our particular metro area, and that we have pockets of county and pockets of city that sit within the metro region of the largest city here in Kern County, which is Bakersfield. So even though you may have the city reporting XYZ number of fatalities, they may not be including the county pockets that have subsequent fatalities or injuries within those areas that are all part of the metro area.
How does it compare to other parts of the state when it comes to this issue of cyclist and pedestrian deaths?
I believe, and I think that the report by the report just issued by the city of Bakersfield echoes what the state has, and I think Kern County is number one or number two within the pedestrian fatality rates for cities our size, and I think we're in top five in the nation, I believe. So we suffer much more greatly than other cities of our size.
So why is that?
Well, I feel that there are many issues. One being we have extremely high speeds on our arterials. 55 miles an hour is a standard arterial speed here in Metro Bakersfield. That combined with a high level of poverty amongst our constituents here in Bakersfield, as well as we are an auto-centric area of Central California. Something that I think is systemic of many small cities that were born of the 1950s post-World War II era here in Central California.
So your group, Vision Zero Kern, hopes to see a future where we don't have these sorts of deaths on our roadways. What would you like to see the city do? They're pointing to new sidewalks, new bike lanes, and a new project in downtown Bakersfield, even bike sharing. What does your group want to see happen in the community to reduce these numbers?
Well, I think for Vision Zero, you know, specifically, I started Vision Zero because it was an international movement that started in Sweden in the 70s and had progressed factual numbers all the way through the 90s, showing that you can reduce the number of fatalities by all four modes of transportation while still increasing traffic flow and increasing automobile use. So it isn't that we want to stall the transportation here in the United States for moving goods and services. What we want to do is encourage people to use active transportation and use the modes of transportation safely. So what we would like to see here in Kern County and in Bakersfield is people in the advocacy world coming together and working to help progress what the city of Bakersfield is now grabbing and gravitating towards, which is a more active transportation friendly community. We want to see a safer and healthier community for the benefits for many of the players involved, whether you're the public health department, whether you're the engineer who's looking at traffic through numbers, or whether you're a developer who's looking to get a more active transportation.
Is there a specific project or something concrete that you can point to that you would like to see undertaken in the community, or is it more about education?
Personally, myself, I'm a League of American Cyclists bicycle instructor. I have worked for the city of Bakersfield doing bicycle education for their police department, their officers, as well as the community at large. I feel that education trumps infrastructure in the sense that education can be applied right now to any situation. Infrastructure often takes a lot of time, a lot of money to get in place. Although I love infrastructure, education seems to be where you can make the most immediate effect for the cheapest dollar, i.e. the biggest bang for the buck.
California in recent years has passed some new laws that give cyclists, or at least aim to give cyclists, more safety on the roadways, including the 3-foot passing law that drivers are supposed to give cyclists at least 3 feet of passing space. Is that being enforced?
I would say that personally, that's probably not being enforced. It's, you know, it's new laws in the book sometimes are a double-edged sword. I am not against the 3-foot passing for safety law, but there's already unsafe passing laws on the books that can be applied. So when you were talking about statistics from the city of Bakersfield's latest safety analysis, conditions analysis, can you give me an idea of how many 3-foot safety violations were written in that same period? How many pedestrian encroachment violations were written in that same situation? So when we derived that a quarter of the incidents were the fault of the driver and 3/4 of the incidents were the fault of either the pedestrian or the cyclist, those are relative numbers not only to the amount of enforcement applied to the other side of the coin via those particular laws that are on the books, but even getting to the fact that when you look at mode share, cyclists and pedestrians make up, I think, somewhere in the nature of 1% of the transportation mode share here in Kern County. So even if it is, you know, 3/4 of them being at fault, they still suffer much more greatly, not only because of the numbers, but because of the damage done to them.
Many drivers who are seeking to go from east to west or west to east in Bakersfield have been looking forward to the 24th Street widening project, closing a gap in Highway 178. Yet there's been a lot of concern about that as well from pedestrian and bicycle advocates, and even some talk about this idea of how to put a crosswalk across that roadway. What are your thoughts on that issue? Is the city doing the right thing there?
Well, I believe that they want to do the right thing. I was 100%, with 100% certainty, I know the city wants to do the right thing. I don't feel it's kind of baffling to me in that the city, I believe, spent $5.5 million on a designer to design a project. The engineering firm brought forward a plan that did not accommodate the movement north and south across 24th Street that would bridge two very long-standing neighborhoods. And subsequently, I'm not sure how that even got to be that point, whereas in regular private business, if you ask someone to bring you plans forward that would include, movement north and south, then you wouldn't accept anything but plans that would include that, and you wouldn't pay unless you were able to get that. And subsequently, we were brought forth a plan as a community here that did not allow for north and south transfer on there. There was some great community-based advocacy that brought forward the desire of the community to have that done. So right now the city has put out a request for the staff to bring them forward options. Now, I don't know why it takes so long and so much uproar to get something that should be so simple. Case in point, I work at a district that in 1921 had two people hit in front of their school as they were going back and forth to the library, and they, within 3 years, had built an underpass that still sits and is working to this day. So it's odd to me that it takes so long for this to get done. The 24th Street project in and of itself is a very interesting project because it actually goes back many, many years into the 60s. So I think that many of the council people's feeling is that it's already so far moved forward that there's just no sense in arguing it. I know the city of Bakersfield really would like to do the right thing here, and hopefully they're going to bring together and bring forward some very safe crosswalk solutions.
It's easy to talk about some of the problems out there, and that's what the media often focus on when we look at things that need fixing. What are some areas, what are some places maybe that are doing a good job in your opinion? Are there any places in the valley that you would point to as a model?
Well, I really like what Delano has done from top to bottom. Their city has gotten behind active transportation. The city of Delano is very proactive within making sure that they have above standard bike lane widths, above standard crosswalk intersection and infrastructure, safety infrastructure implementation, such as illuminated crosswalks, et cetera, et cetera. They also have taken it a step further and done a lot of, as I mentioned before, this ATP grant funding can do a lot to not only add infrastructure, but add education. And they have grabbed onto that every time. They've gone after it with a professional grant writing group and been successful at bringing not only infrastructure change, but education to their elementaries and their middle schools. There in Delano, recognizing that they have an obesity issue that is partially addressed with more active transportation-friendly communities. I think that they are a definite model within the community here in Kern County.
We've been talking with Zachary Griffin. He is the director of Vision Zero Kern, a group that's committed to reducing the deaths of pedestrians, cyclists, and others on Bakersfield streets and Kern County streets, talking about new data out about those deaths on Bakersfield roadways. Zachary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful day.
Stay with us here on Valley Edition in the second half of our program today. A look at sex trafficking in the Valley, and how do traffickers lure young women into a life that's called modern-day slavery by many? That and a preview of the Fresno Film Festival, all to come this hour on Valley Edition.
Hey Siri, open the Valley Public Radio app.
Opening KVPR.
It's true, Valley Public Radio now has its own mobile app. Whether you're an Android or Apple user, our new app for smartphones and tablets is available for download now. You'll find one-touch access to our live audio stream, featured local and national news stories, podcasts, and more. There's even an alarm and sleep function. Find it today in the Apple App Store and on Google Play. Just search KVPR.
We spent all this sweat and blood to figure out what kind of nation we were going to become for birds.
What does a duck hunting feud between our founding fathers have to do with a white kid's fight to be the top cop in hip-hop?
Oh, wow.
He's on a black station dissing black people. Like, who are you?
I'm on a hip-hop station. I have to diss black people sometimes.
Find out on the next Radiolab.
Saturday at noon on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A new reporting project from the Fresno Bee seeks to shine a light on a story that is too often in the shadows all around us: human trafficking. The multimedia project Slaves of the Sex Trade launched last week and underscores not only the extent of the problem, but the way in which many young women are lured into a life of modern-day slavery, usually beginning online.
The younger generation is so constantly has an internet presence, but it also makes them present and available for traffickers, and they can do, it can start off very slow with just like a like on a picture, and then 2 weeks later, it can be a comment. And then another week later, a question about what's going on with their situation. And then slowly, the victim believes that they actually have a real relationship with this person online who they may have never met.
The reporters behind the project, Rory and Alexandra Appleton, join us now to talk about this project, which is rolling out already on the Fresno Bee's website, but over the next 6 weeks, more stories to come. Rory and Alexandra, thanks so much for joining us today. I want to start with you, Rory. This is a problem that's not unique to Fresno or the Valley. Do we have any idea of the scope of the problem here, maybe as it compares to elsewhere in California?
Yeah, well, actually, as bad as it is, you know, here, it's recently become a major focus of all the law enforcement. The district attorney has recently started a human trafficking, you know, basically section of the district attorney's office. But as bad as it is here, Fresno is actually ranked 7th in the state in terms of calls to the human trafficking hotline for help, for assistance for others. So as bad as it is here, it actually can be much, much worse in some of the larger cities and also some of the poorer communities, because a lot of these problems are just go largely unreported for so long. So it is something that we had been wanting to look at. The project started we were just going to do, you know, one story, and then we just kept talking to people, and it just kept getting so much more compelling. All these people have such, you know, just horrible stories of things that have happened to them that we just have started broadening out, and we're still sort of broadening it out.
Now, Alexandra, we opened with a short clip from one of your videos. You did all the videos for this project, mm-hmm. and it's a great one. It's about 12 minutes long on the Fresno Bee's website right now. Is there anything like a typical story from the women that you talk to?
There is, actually. A lot of the women we talk to are not who TV and movies depict as the common trafficking victim. They grew up in solid families. They went to good schools. They were good students. And they met their traffickers on social media. The traffickers typically posed as a romantic relationship and kind of charmed them into this life and initially took them out on dates and paid lots of attention to them, kind of helped those self-esteem issues that were underlying. And at some point, they changed the relationship and it became, well, just do this for us once and make some money. And then if the woman resisted, it would turn into violence. And we heard that happen quite a few times.
Now, Rory, you talk to people who have been involved, unfortunately, in this over many years, in some cases going back a number of years ago. Has social media changed this in any way?
Yeah. What surprised me is when talking to experts, they all pretty much unanimously said that the problem is even worse than it was, say, 5 years ago. Even though, if you look at the laws, much harsher penalties for people who are trafficking other people. Human trafficking itself wasn't a law until 2012. But it's become much worse because of the prevalence of social media as well as the sort of online community. One major issue is that there are newer ways of communicating online that come out every week, and it's impossible for law enforcement And a lot of times parents to sort of keep up with the children who are using these new forms of communication. I know the one police detective who took us out with the Vice Unit told us that there are apps on kids' phones that he's seen that they look like they're a calculator if you're just thumbing through the phone. But if you get in there, it's a way of communicating with other people, and it's a lot of times their parents don't know. A lot of times law enforcement is slow to track it because they don't know either. And so I think the amount of people who can be targeted pretty easily is so high now that the problem has not gotten any better.
I want to go back to something you just said. Human trafficking was not against the law until 2012 in California. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so basically human trafficking as it sort of exists, which is, using force, fear, coercion, it's separated into either labor trafficking, you're forcing somebody to work for you, or sex trafficking, which is essentially, the sex trade. Prostitution has obviously always been a crime, but you've seen in the last 5 years this switch from using prostitution as a sort of a way to get these women off the street, arresting them, having them go through the system, trying to get them rehabilitated that way. You've seen a change, especially in Fresno, away from that and more towards trying to help them. And the police, in turn, have seen a very, very high improvement in terms of those women being willing to help law enforcement get traffickers off the street. And so this new trafficking law, it was actually enacted after the people voted. There was a prop on it. And it has very harsh penalties. If you traffic a minor, which a lot of these cases, we were talking to experts, a lot of these women have been contacted by the time they're 16. If you traffic a minor now, it can be life in prison. So there's been an increase in the penalties and they've been busting more pimps, but it is nonetheless still worse just through, communication.
Alexandra, you talked to so many women as part of this project who have escaped this life. Have any of the men who coerce them into this life been brought to justice in those individual cases?
I believe we heard from the Fresno Police Department that it used to be that busting one or two pimps a year was considered a good year, say 10 years ago. But, recently and last year, busting 15 to 16, which they did, I believe they did, is what is now a good year.
How difficult was it to report on this project, talk to some of these women and hear their stories?
It's definitely, especially with the ones that you can tell are still struggling with it, your heart just goes out to them as you're sitting there. You want to reassure them and help them. But they were all absolutely troopers, and they all, once they get over the initial nervousness, they were eloquent and powerful and passionate, and it was great to hear.
Alexandra, I asked you if there was a typical story on the way that people got involved in this life. Is there a typical story on the way people get out?
It's actually all different in that regard. We've heard a lot of women who reach out initially, but then end up going back into the life because they're not ready. And we've talked to another victim who really tried to get out on her own, but found herself turned down by society, by jobs, by a lack of opportunity that she felt like giving up to. So there's a bit of recidivism in each story, but they do end up all sounding a little different.
Rory, you wrote something that I think many may read as surprising, that this is not just a South of Shaw problem. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so that was probably one of the more interesting things. When we went out with the Vice Unit and we spoke to the supervisor who's going to be in throughout the stories, actually this week's story is going to be focused directly on the police, and we went on a ride along several undercover operations with the Fresno Police Department. And one of the things that he told me is, a few years ago, it was probably true that this was a problem that was mainly just south of Shaw. You just saw in the same sort of areas of town, Parkway, Belmont, things like that. But now with that rise of social media, with, I think there are some other factors too that a lot of people want to add, in terms of the police saying that, women and girls have, you know, a little bit more freedom in terms of what they're going out and doing. That's something that's been brought up a couple of times by advocates as well as the law enforcement. But also, they think because of social media mainly, they've seen, and we asked him and he said, you know, every school he's had girls trafficked out of, Clovis North, Clovis West, you know, all the sort of, I think a lot of people who live in Northeast Fresno and Clovis sort of think that there's this kind of wall. And for some it's Shaw Avenue, for some it's Herndon Avenue, and I think this is something that is definitely affecting people north of that. We heard a very compelling story about a middle school students who had basically, they were turned down by their parents for money for the mall and were out trafficking themselves. Like, you know, having sex with men, and then they eventually got ensnared by a trafficker because he asked them to join his sort of stable, and they said, you know, oh, no, we're not doing it like that. And then he had them beaten and robbed, and then later came back to them and said, I can protect you. And then they're trapped like that. There's all kinds of situations like that that are happening all over the city as well as the county.
You also write that the high rate of runaways contributes to this problem. Mm-hmm. I didn't know we had a high rate of runaways. Tell me more about that.
So yeah, we do. We have a pretty high rate of runaways. I don't remember exactly where we rank in California, but it was definitely, I think, top five-ish or so, as well as the high poverty rate. I mean, at Fresno, everybody knows it's got a pretty high poverty rate. I think of the largest, you know, cities in California, we have the highest. I think I've heard the police department say that between 10 and 12% of juvenile runaways are sexually trafficked in terms of the girls. Boys and men being trafficked is something that the local law enforcement and advocates really don't see that often. They believe that it happens, but apparently, because a lot of trafficking is done through the gangs, apparently there's some sort of idea that even the gangs won't touch trafficking a young boy, selling a boy for sex. For some reason, it's just sort of a taboo thing. That's what the law enforcement tells us. So anyways, you see, you know, between 10 and 12% of the runaways having some sort of trafficking experience or being victimized sexually or anything like that. And so I think both of those, and then I think one of the really main factors is that Fresno is so centrally located because you've got huge, huge trafficking numbers in the Bay Area, mainly Oakland, and you've got huge trafficking areas in Los Angeles. And then obviously in Las Vegas, it's as big as it can be. And so a lot of the women that we interviewed are from here. They were recruited here, but a lot of them were moved to Southern California, to Northern California, out of the states. I mean, we had just recently a man was arrested who had trafficked a girl from the ages where she was 12 to 16 across the whole country. She had been trafficked in Miami and Atlanta, and that's as a 12-year-old, and she was a runaway. And so you see this sort of situation happen with these traffickers are looking for isolated girls. If they're runaways, then obviously they're quite isolated. But a lot of these traffickers will try and drive wedges between girls and their families in order to make them run away. And then they've got them. Once they've got them isolated, those girls will do what they have to basically survive. And that's exactly where a trafficker wants you.
Not to ask you to scoop your own story, but elaborate a little more on what you were talking about earlier with the Fresno police and this different strategy. How is that working out?
Yeah, so as Alex said, they've had a much higher rate of arresting traffickers, what a lot of people would still call pimps, and that language is sort of used interchangeably a little bit, but for the most part, everybody kind of prefers traffickers because pimp, you know, a pandering charge, sort of a pimping charge, is a much lesser offense than a human trafficking charge. So what they've noticed is that they've had, you know, by treating these girls as victims when they go out and talk with them, they've had a lot more success. I mean, and we went out with the vice unit, and they had advocates with them in their undercover cars who were ready to talk to these girls. We saw girls who could have easily been arrested that were contacted and not arrested and given phone numbers and, you know, had nice long conversations with them and you know, referred to for help. I mean, without any sort of expectation of, you know, you're going to, you know, there were women out there who didn't, who weren't being trafficked, who didn't have a trafficker, who were being helped through this. So basically the stories that I have coming out, it'll be online on Thursday of this week. And it is basically going through both that, you know, their new tactics, as well as how these traffickers operate. The police went into great detail over, and a lot of readers have gotten to me and wanted to know how this happens. But it's exactly how the different strategies are for a trafficker. You know, how they're the most common that we found and what's been growing is this sort of, they call them a Romeo pimp. It's a boyfriend pimp, where it starts as a relationship and you might have a year-long relationship. You might bring him around your family and everything like that. But all of it is planned so that he'll get you in that one vulnerable moment where, don't you want to live together? Don't you want to not get a nice apartment together? If you just do this one thing one time, we can do that. There's that kind of pimp. There's the more what I think people are more conditioned to fear, which is something that has gone a little bit out of style, which is the sort of, they call them the gorilla pimp, which is basically you are kidnapping young girls. That doesn't happen as often. And then there are other kinds too. And there are other ways that they're getting in touch. And that's what the upcoming story is going to focus on.
Alexandra, talking to the women that are featured in your videos, is there anything that they advise parents or others, even young women themselves, to be alert for? Anything that they could have done differently? Any advice that they offer?
Sure. I asked all of them that question. And one of the most agreed upon pieces of advice is, if a relationship feels wrong, if you're feeling coerced, if you're doing things you don't want to do, that's a red flag and you need to get out. Another one that most agreed on is, if you are being driven away from your family and friends, your support network, if your friends and family are telling you this is not a good person, you should really try to listen to them. And they all acknowledge that it's a head versus heart situation. But the idea is, if you follow your instincts, you're in a good spot. But for parents, you know, that we did hear a lot of, you pay attention to what your girls are doing, pay attention to what your sons are doing too, and make sure that that's all healthy.
Well, one of the things that one of the women brought up to us was, for individuals, especially young teenage girls, to not post so much of their feelings on social media. One of them was, her name is Arian Pauls, and she's one of the more vocal, you know, advocates. She's been on all kinds of newscasts and stuff like that. She was contacted through MySpace, and she believes that her trafficker contacted her just because she had feelings of helplessness, of feeling alone, of not making enough money for her family and for her goals and things like that. And she believes that she was targeted because of those posts online. So that's another thing, is to keep your feeling posts sort of limited on social media.
And before we go, you had one line in this report that absolutely jumped out at me. I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but the individual you were talking to said just about every young woman online in Fresno County has probably been messaged or contacted in some way by one of these people. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Did that shock you as much as it shocked me?
That was an absolutely shocking thing. And we had a lot of people who contacted us through social media, through emails and stuff like that, who were just, you know, in disbelief about that. But the detective that we were out with is a 20-year veteran, has been on sex crimes, I think, for about 12, 13 years. He's been in Vice Unit, I'm sorry. And he was adamant about it. He thinks every 16-year-old in this area, and we spoke to, for later stories, it'll be, you know, further out, we spoke to Miko Anderson, who's the district attorney who specifically just does trafficking cases. And she's like, that's probably true. I mean, we did check this to make sure it wasn't just so out of left field that it wasn't true. But they believe that because of social media, and it's little things. I mean, he says that basically girls and women who have sort of regular healthy self-esteem and family background, things like that, a lot of times they just disregard it or they don't even notice it. I mean, if you look on your Facebook, for example, if you have a Facebook, there is this section in your messages section that says message requests, and that's somebody who's not your friend, not connected to you in any way, trying to get in touch with you. And that was, you know, a lot of people might see that and just sort of ignore it. And that's what this detective was talking about. But he believes, I mean, really and truly, that by the time a girl is 16, she's been contacted by a trafficker in some way. She might have been approached on the street and just immediately ran away. She might have been talked to online. But that is the firm belief of the police department, because we did check with, you know, the sergeant who is his supervisor, and they believe that.
Alexandra, I'll give you the last word here. Are the people you're talking to, are they optimistic that this is going to get better, that they're going to make progress on reducing this, or is there a fear that things are going the other way?
There is a fear that their resources are being overwhelmed. Most of these advocate groups, they need donations, they need volunteers, they need regular staff, and all of those resources are being exceeded. But I don't think we talked to anyone who believes that it's a hopeless case.
Again, Alexandra and Rory Appleton joining us today. They are the husband and wife team behind a new series from the Fresno Bee called Slaves of the Sex Trade. It launched last week, and it's available online at fresnobee.com and rolling out over the next 6 weeks in the paper and online. Excellent job on this very difficult topic. Did a great job reporting this, both of you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This weekend, Fresno's Tower Theater will be home to 8 feature-length films from 9 countries. It's part of the 13th annual Fresno Film Festival presented by Fresno Filmworks. And joining us now, we have with us Justice Beer Stanberry, member of the Fresno Filmworks Board, to talk about what's on tap for this year's festival. Justice, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
13 years of doing this. It seems like it just started yesterday, but a great lineup this year of films from across the globe. Mm-hmm. Is there a particular theme to this year's festival, or what are you trying to accomplish with the festival this year?
Yeah, well, we don't have an official theme, but, you know, in picking the films, we kind of noticed they all have a central thing in common, kind of with fighting back. A lot of the films deal with people who are facing some sort of oppression in one way or another.
And you have all sorts of different films. Mm-hmm. You start out with a film about the jazz great Django Reinhardt, mm-hmm. a period piece. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a musical biopic. It's based on the life of famous European jazz musician Django Reinhardt. It focuses on the years 1943 to 45, I believe, in the middle of World War II. He's making a big name for himself in Paris. He ends up having to use his music really to escape. He's being, you know, sought after because of his heritage as a Romani, I guess what would have then been called a gypsy. And his jazz music became known as gypsy swing, and really was an influential musician even for American jazz musicians.
And that opens up the festival on Friday night, November 10th at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. You go on into Saturday. Before we get to those films, how do you go about selecting the films? How does that work? Because that has to be a lot of fun, but a big job as well.
Definitely. Very time-consuming task. Usually for our monthly film series, we as board members nominate films and we vote on one to choose. But for the festival, we have a small committee on our board that really sifts through a lot of films. They, you know, they're kind of in tune with all the festival films that are making news right now, but then they go through all those and they choose the ones that'll really be best for our audience.
So how does it work? Do filmmakers or distributors give you a call and say, hey, we have this film we think would be great for Fresno's festival.
Right.
What do we have to do to get it in? Or are you going out and looking, seeking out films?
Yeah, good question. We definitely have to seek out the films. Our board members have relationships with the distributors, longstanding good relationships. So they know where to go to find the films. And so we seek them out and get permission to use the film.
All right. So Saturday, you start up at noon with a film, The Force. We'll have to go through these relatively quickly, but tell us briefly about these films that are coming up on Saturday.
Yeah, Saturday we start with The Force. It's a documentary that follows the Oakland Police Force. And, you know, a lot of news with the police force in that area. It's kind of in a post-Ferguson world how the police deals with the community.
Mm-hmm.
Next up on Saturday is The Divine Order, a film from Switzerland. And this one is actually getting a lot of Oscar buzz on shortlists for a foreign film nomination. So that one is really going to be good. Next on Saturday in Syria is a film from Belgium and France. And this one was at the Berlin Film Festival. Got a lot of great reviews there. Then Saturday night we have I Dream in Another Language, a Mexican film. And this one is one I'm really excited about. It deals with a journalist, a researcher, trying to seek out a nearly extinct language. And it's pretty interesting. It deals with kind of a mythology of the language. He finds out that the two people that speak the language still haven't spoken to each other in 50 years.
Wow.
So it becomes a task for him to try to get these two people to speak to each other. We get into the history of, you know, their backstory with flashbacks, and it deals with the history of the language, which is supposed to be some sort of bond between man and animals, some sort of communication.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah.
Before we get to the Sunday films, what is the value of, in this world today where you can get a stream just about anything,
right,
anywhere?
Right.
In the convenience of your home, all these different streaming services, everything online. What is the rationale to continue doing films in theaters, especially
right,
things that have very focused audiences? Why still do a film festival in this day and
age? Well, I mean, I would say that, first of all, these films that we choose, even in the advent of streaming, I'd say are very difficult to find. And so this really is your one chance to see these kinds of films. And that's really our goal as for the Fresno Filmworks, is to bring Fresno these films that they most likely will not see anywhere else, certainly not at the big theaters here, and probably even not on streaming services. So we want to bring these films that we think are culturally relevant, kind of eye-opening, and you're not going to see anywhere else.
All right, before we go, we've got just a couple minutes left here. Sunday, November 12th, you open up again at noon. Our Time Will Come. What's that film about?
Our Time Will Come is a film from China and Hong Kong, and another story of resistance. And this one is a young woman that has to, because of her family situation, really has to take things into her own hands and kind of protect her family. So that's going to be a really interesting one, exciting. And then we have Unleashed. This one's one of our more lighthearted films of the festival. It's a comedy. A young woman who has a few pets end up turning into humans, essentially.
All right.
Yeah. And so that's definitely an interesting dynamic there. And we'll have a filmmaker Q&A. The director will be there afterwards, visiting from Hollywood to answer some questions after that screening. And then Sunday night, the Women's Balcony is one of the biggest films that we have. It's from Israel. A female group in a synagogue loses their congregation spot in the synagogue, and they have to fight against a more ultra-conservative rabbi to kind of get their space back.
Again, it's coming up this weekend at the Tower Theater in Fresno. Justice Pierce Stanberry with Fresno Filmworks presenting the 13th Annual Fresno Film Festival, November 10 through 12. If people want information, what's your website?
FresnoFilmworks.org.
We'll look for that and look for this film festival again. Justice, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet. We are @KVPR, and download our app our mobile app, the KVPR app, available for Android and Apple platforms at the respective app stores online. For Valley Edition reporters Kerry Klein, Jeffrey Hess, and Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.